The Russians bought ads to cause chaos on Facebook. Brad Sams is here to guess at what we'll see at the next surface event. And dolphins attack. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1847, recorded Wednesday, September 6th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to save 20% off any order. Hey there, welcome to Tech News Today. We're here for you because you want the tech news. We've got it. And we're willing to share it with you.
We don't hoard the tech news. We share the tech news.
I feel like we kind of hoard it all day, and then we get ready, and then here we are to share.
And then we open the gates, and we let the tech news just fly out like seagulls or doves. Maybe
yes,
doves.
Doves.
Yeah, you probably don't want seagulls. That's a mess just waiting to happen.
No. The tech news is like doves. Flying into your eyes or ears right now.
Yes, including this story. Oh, I'm Jason. She's Megan.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
There we go. You know this already. Why do we have to spell that out for you? Anyways, 2 days after the 2016 U.S. election, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg stated publicly that the idea the fake news on its network influenced the election in any way was, in fact, a crazy idea. However, starting in the summer of 2015, apparently, a Russian company began buying Facebook ads to the tune of $100,000 to stir political uncertainty. As part of an investigation that started earlier this spring, Facebook found 3,300 ads on its network that did this, all pointing back to the same Russian company. Not only that, Facebook discovered 470 likely fraudulent Facebook accounts and pages linked to the same company that it says likely helped to promote and spread those ads across the network to get that all-important network effect so that, you know, many people saw it. Although Facebook isn't sharing exactly how many people were exposed to this, $100,000 for an ad campaign that stretched out over the course of a little more than a year doesn't seem like a whole lot. I don't know how much of an impact $100,000 could have as far as ad campaign spend is concerned.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know either. Someone who buys ads on Facebook maybe could help us out with that. TNT at twit.tv. I know. This was Facebook's own investigation. They weren't being investigated by anyone else. This was their investigation into the politically motivated ads. What's interesting is that these ads didn't mention candidates. They didn't mention the election. They didn't even mention voting. They just mentioned very divisive topics, and they wanted to amplify them, and they wanted to cause chaos, which is what they did. Clearly. So they succeeded in that. It's a tough one. They said they've shut down the fraudulent accounts. Just a lot of bad news for Facebook today.
Targeted issues included LGBT, black social issues, Second Amendment, immigration. This same company, apparently it's called, it's a firm based out of St. Petersburg Internet Research Agency. Yeah. Wow, that's such there's not a whole lot of personality behind that name. That could, it really could be any company. Apparently, this same company spread a hoax regarding a chemical link in Louisiana back in 2014. And in that case, also kind of, you know, for the purposes of kind of instilling fear and chaos into the situation. So they have a background in this, apparently. But it just kind of goes to show. I mean, I'd be curious to see the ads. Facebook isn't sharing what the ads were, isn't sharing the actual effect of these ads on the network, how many people were exposed. And I think that's actually a pretty important element to know how much it actually, you know, how much this particular ad campaign actually held as far as influence over what people were seeing. But it certainly adds to the noise and adds to the chaos. And as we know, there was a lot of noise, and there still probably is on Facebook around these kinds of topics. Another question that I have is the fact that federal law prohibits foreign nationals and governments from spending money to influence a federal, state, or local election. Kind of remains to be seen whether this is actually falls into that category, because they apparently this particular firm has links to those in the Russian government. So is this, could this be extended to paying to influence an election, or is this just pushing, you know, pushing an idea? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's a kind of a blurry, there's a blurry line between those two things. And where does that fall?
Right. Because we know that there's been research into people were paid to post on Facebook, to mm-hmm. post fake news. There were, you know, lots of Russians just, you know, this was their job. They were getting paid a certain amount of money in order to use their Facebook account to spread fake news. But these are advertisements. So that this is, the money is being given to Facebook. Facebook took this money. Mm-hmm. They profited from it. So it's really, it's more complicated. I would like to see the ads because I want to see how much they look like Facebook stories that someone's sharing. You know, is that right. Like, And we know from many psychological studies that we want to read news that confirms what we already believe or know, and mm-hmm. it makes us feel good, or it riles us up, or whatever it is. It's why we go to Facebook often, just to be in that echo chamber and just like, oh yeah, I knew I felt that way. And it's part of, like, we continually get emails about, please stop talking about politics. And I get it. But then I feel like people keep also sending those emails and talking about politics in those emails, you know? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's interesting because I do think it's why people often enjoy listening to people who disagree with them too. There's something about getting confirmed what you already believe and also hearing an opposite opinion that triggers something inside us that makes us, I wouldn't say feel good, but has something to do with endorphins, I think.
I wouldn't say feel good either.
No. Well, it doesn't feel good after you eat a bag of Doritos, but we still eat that.
Yeah, time again.
Mm-hmm. And more bad Facebook news. An analyst at Pivotal Research Group says Facebook is claiming to reach people who do not exist. Facebook's ad manager said the company reaches 40, this is the ad manager tool, claimed that the company reaches 41 million young adults between the ages of 18 to 24 in the United States. However, recent census data says there are only 31 million 18 to 24-year-olds living in the U.S., so that's actually less than what Facebook says they reach in that age range. Facebook has responded to the report saying it stands by its data, which also occurs in other age groups. They also say they reach more people in other age groups than actually exist. They acknowledge recent errors in their advertising system that we've talked about in the past couple of months, but this isn't one of them. So who are all these ghost people using Facebook?
Ooh, they're ghosts. They're actual ghosts.
I mean, they said that it's how many. Oh, yeah, there they are. Oh. There's me and my other Facebook accounts. How many people are in a given area are eligible to see an ad a business might run? So they're talking about little, you know, areas and then multiplying them, I guess. They say they use two different methodologies for collecting data. And this census data is from 2016. So what do you make of this?
I think, the fact that they're estimates, I think, is kind of a critical component of this. In my opinion, both Facebook and Census Bureau data are estimates. It relies on people properly identifying themselves, if they identify themselves at all. So census, relies on people including themselves in the count. So likely there are people that don't include themselves in the count that are in fact Facebook users. There's also, on Facebook, a lot of people self-report their age, misreport their age. Maybe they report, maybe they're 13 and they report as 15 because that gives them extra access to something, and then they age out. And so that's a misrepresentation to get past those age barriers. And then there's also the idea that, there are a lot of people that visit and Facebook is using location data to identify people as being here and falling into those age categories and including it. So according to the U.S. Commerce Data Department data, 5.6 million non-residents visited the U.S. in January. And so when you take that and compact that, like, yeah, I could kind of see it. I understand where Facebook's coming from on this. There, census, like we said, it's an estimate. Facebook has actual data behind it. The problem is Facebook's previous problems in this regard don't instill a whole lot of faith in Facebook to tell, you know, to be telling the truth. But I understand where they're coming from.
That's a $10 million. I mean, 10 million people difference. Mm-hmm. That's a lot. Like they're saying 41 million and it's only 30 and the census off by 10 million. That's a lot. Or like, are you talking about people that are in college, or I don't know.
When you take a look at the U.S. Commerce Department data, 5.6 million non-residents visited U.S. in January alone. So if you've got a lot of people visiting and you got a lot of people, A, visiting the U.S., B, so many people on Facebook. I mean, how much of the world's population is on Facebook? So you better believe when they're traveling, they're also using Facebook. That's logging by location. I don't know. I could see it. I don't know if it accounts for all of that, but I'm pretty certain that's a pretty reasonable number to make up that data point. I just don't know if it adds up entirely, but
I understand. I don't believe anything Facebook says. I mean, after today, I'm really like, really? Do I really want to spend a minute more on Facebook? I don't know.
Well, you know how I feel about that.
I do know how you feel about it.
One thing we might take for granted with our voice assistants is that voice part. We expect that our voice assistants will respond to an actual voice, our voice, if we've set it up properly, securing the data or the device and the data on the device to keep other people out of our digital bits. But a new technique called Dolphin Attack, developed by a team from Zhejiang University, utilizes ultrasonic frequencies to take control of the most popular voice assistants, and the human ear can't even hear it. Can't even detect the frequencies. Siri assistant and Amazon's voice assistant and more can all be tricked into firing off commands in seeming silence as a result. And I mean, really, this is just how speakers, how microphones are designed, right? Like they're designed to pick up a certain spectrum of frequencies. And so I'm thinking probably the only way that like they're all, I can't talk today. I'm sorry. They're all unable to filter this out right now. But maybe what they can do is that they can detect when a command is coming from a frequency that is outside a frequency that a human could actually speak. But from what I could tell here, there's no easy way to just filter that out entirely.
This is some bad news day. This was the Apple Watch, smart locks, the Amazon Echo, Siri. Like, I have to give up Facebook and my iPhone, and I have to give up everything today.
Yeah, just give it all up.
So you have to be within six feet. So,
yeah, of the Apple Watch. Other devices, you had to be closer. So other devices, it's actually a little less effective, right? Like, basically, the researchers took a smartphone and $3 worth of extra hardware, including a small speaker and an amplifier. And in most of the devices, it required this setup to be within a few inches of the device. So there you're talking like if it's an Android Wear device or whatever, or assistant on a phone or Siri on a phone, you'd have to be really close and timed perfectly. Like, and the person that owns that device would have to not notice that their phone woke up and everything like that. So there's a lot of kind of gimmies. What I would be worried about on something like this is a Google Home or an Echo that's tied into your home network to power the smart lock on your front door and being able to send a signal to say, unlock the front door, and then be able to get in and take stuff. But if it really has this few inch restriction, that's a little bit less of a worry, depending on where you have your Echo stored.
Right. Yeah. I'm not bringing my Echo anywhere, but like I could be sitting on the park bench with my Apple Watch, and it could talk to my devices and open my door. But remember, I have the big dog.
Yeah. Yes. Everyone that's listening right now, she does have a big dog. So I can attest to that.
You cannot hack him.
That's true. I mean, they're also kind of stressing the idea that maybe there's only so much a voice assistant can do right now, but there's the potential of gaining access and then getting in there and mucking things up underneath so that it can, you know, install malware or whatever. I don't know if we're necessarily seeing that happening. In fact, there's nothing in this article that points to that actually happening, but there's the potential to that. And now that this is freely accessible, you know, the plan to do this is out there. People can totally do this if they really want to with $3 worth of extra hardware. Then it's out there for the taking. Burke says, is the signal just the part of the command above human hearing frequency? Yeah, the signal that's coming in. Yeah.
Cut off the human, like you record it, you know, then you just cut off the part.
Oh,
that you hear,
Oh, that's a good question. So what Burke is asking is if it's the part of the... So if I was to say a command, a voice command, and you were to filter out everything below a certain frequency that we could actually hear, is everything above that from my actual recording what's triggering this? I don't know the answer to that. I couldn't find out exactly what was being transmitted. It kind of reminded me, based on what I understood, of what we talked about in the past about image recognition and object recognition in like autonomous vehicles. Seeing a sign and with an invisible filter that we can't see but that the computer can see, that kind of changes the deciphering of that message entirely. That's kind of my impression of this, but maybe it is that, Burke. I don't know.
I guess my favorite part of this story is it's the best named vulnerability, right? Like dolphin attack.
Dolphin attack. I wonder how accurate it is. Does it really feel like a dolphin's attacking when this happens to you?
You know why it's called dolphin attack, right? Because of the dolphins that... that make noises that we can't hear?
No, I just want to... I'm just wondering what it's like to be attacked by a dolphin.
Okay. I don't want to find out.
Okay.
That's all I have to say.
Let's not go there. All right. Fine.
Now, of all the possible Apple scandal names, I've chosen to call this next one Dugout Gate. The New York Times reports that those sneaky Red Sox used an Apple Watch to steal signals during baseball games against the New York Yankees. And yes, thank you. Many have seen this headline and responded with, at least somebody found a use for the Apple Watch. Ha 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 ha. They didn't steal it like the dolphin attack. There was no dolphin attack here. Here's how it worked. The Yankees have video showing the Red Sox staff stealing signs, those hand signals, from the Yankee pitchers and then sending them to someone in the dugout to pass along to the Red Sox batters. According to Mike Murphy at Quartz, Major League Baseball has banned sign stealing with a mechanical device since 1961. So the Red Sox have admitted to the sign stealing. They will likely get a slap on the wrist, which is, of course, protected by your Apple Watch, so no need to worry. I am disappointed in this. Ed Riley, who watches the show, he emailed me, and he's like, this is sad for kids, like, just because, is this what it's come to? Like, what about just the fun of the game? The popcorn, the peanuts. If you build it, they'll come. I have all of the baseball things. Actually, that's Field of Dreams.
Yeah, that works.
I don't know. That's all my baseball metaphors.
All the movies that you've seen. Wow, Burke.
Burke doesn't like baseball.
Burke claims worst game ever.
I guess he doesn't like apple pie either, or America.
I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with this. Like, this sort of thing has been banned for a long time with any sort of device. But here's what I don't understand. Okay, so MLB has limited technology in other ways. Smartphones are banned from the dugout. iPad Pros are allowed, but not accessible to the internet. So the internet is shut off. They basically have preloaded content on there.
Like Netflix movies and stuff they can watch while they're...
Yeah, they're going to watch Field of Dreams. That's okay, preloaded on there. So when they're not out batting, they're watching a baseball movie. That's how it goes in MLB. But Apple Watches are allowed, and I don't understand why that is, that Apple Watches are allowed, because you had to know, like, eventually something like this is going to happen, especially because on Apple Watch, can't you, like, draw on it and the drawing appears on somebody else's? Like, that would be really... Mm-hmm. Really easy to pass communication really fast.
Right. Or they could send their heartbeat to the pitcher just to confuse him or something.
Your heartbeat is really elevated, pitcher. We need you to come off the mat or stay out there. Maybe that's how he performs better.
So the players themselves didn't have the Apple Watch. It was someone in the dugout who was getting all the secret messages.
I think it's pretty obvious that this would be against the rules. I don't know why they thought they could get away with it, but... Hey, Deflategate was the thing too in the NFL, and it's probably that whole rule of don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm, probably. After the break, Brad Sams is here to make some educated guesses about the next Surface product that's rumored to be unveiled this fall. But first, let's take a minute to thank The Tracker. They are the sponsor of this episode. I have around 12 different apps that remind me to do all the stuff I need to be reminded to do. I get reminders on my Apple Watch. That's what I use it for. I get reminders on this thing, my computer, all my Amazon Echoes. But no matter how often I remind myself not to lose stuff, it just doesn't take. That is why I put trackers on everything. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you will never have to worry about losing your things again. And we all need a little less worry in our lives these days, I think. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You just place it on whatever you tend to lose, keys, wallets. You can even put it on your cat if you lose your cat often, or if your cat tries to get away from you, or your dog. It's small enough to fit on the smallest items. When you misplace something that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you just use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. Just open up that app. It's basically the same thing as an app that reminds you, but you get to press a button and then you can hear a sound and you can find out where your device is. It has a powerful LED light so that you can find your items in the dark. If you lose your phone, you just press the button on your Tracker Pixel and then your phone rings, even if it's on silent. Now you can locate items if you've lost them under the couch or you've left them upstairs or in a cabinet, but you can even locate stuff if it's miles away. If you left it at the beach and then you went home and you forgot about it. Every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. And you get a little alert when you help locate someone else's stuff that they've lost. It feels good. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you truly have nothing to lose. Here's what you do. Go to thetracker.com, enter promo code TNT to save 20% off any order. If this sounds good to you, go do it right now. You can pause and then come back. We'll be here for you. And we thank Tracker for their support of Tech News Today. Sources at The Verge say Microsoft will hold its annual fall Surface event in London this year. Here to talk to us about what we might see at the event is Brad Sams, podcaster and executive editor at Petri.com and Throt.com. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So a new Surface Book, a new Surface Pro LTE model. What do you think we're going to see?
So if we take a step back here, this was very interesting because Microsoft typically doesn't announce things this way. And I almost wonder if this was completely accidental or if we're not getting the whole story, because the reason why I say that is last time Microsoft launched new hardware that was not in the U.S. was the Surface Pro, which they did in China. They told us, the press, 10 to 14 days before that event. And here we are, Microsoft letting out of the bag that they're going to have a Surface event in 6 to 7 weeks. That doesn't really align with their typical go-to-market type strategies for these types of things. So there's a couple thoughts here. What are they going to announce? You know, there's a lot of things up in the air. A refresh. The Surface Book is very long in the tooth at this point. It's still running Skylake. Intel's got some new stuff. So it very much seems like we're going to see a spec bump there. We could see a spec bump across the Surface Studio as well. But on the other side of the coin, there could also still be a New York event. Typically, when Microsoft launches new stuff, especially Surface stuff, they like to do it out of New York. It's very easy for the press to get through. There's a lot of people there. They get a lot of good stuff. And the thing where The Verge is talking about here, which I fully believe them, that Panos is going to be at that event. Microsoft, I believe, has done every year for the past couple of years. It's called a Decoded event, and where there's just high publicity speakers, and they come and, you know, and they talk about their wares. And so I almost wonder if it's still possible that Microsoft would do an event earlier in October or sometime in October, and then they'd have more of like an international event later in the month at this Decoded event. So this just seems very out of the usual for what Microsoft typically does for a hardware release.
Maybe they just wanted, you know, Apple was getting all this attention about their event. Maybe they were like, we have an event too.
Yeah, I mean, they very much could. I don't know why Microsoft would feel they would need to do that. They typically haven't done that in the past. And let's be just really candid. They're not going to get any sort of big press wave out of it compared to what Apple does during their events. And so when this first came across the wire, I was talking to some companions, and I honestly said, I think Microsoft's press just screwed up. I think that this was not supposed to go out in this way. I don't think that they intended for this to happen. And yet here we are, where they've confirmed that there's going to be a Surface launch or some sort of event in London at the end of October. And they only told one outlet to get that news out. Just, it doesn't feel like, I don't know of any other company that would do anything like that.
Mm.
So.
So what do you think about the Surface Studio? The Surface Studio was announced last year at this fall event, right? So it was almost a year ago. And you said maybe we'll see an upgrade in the hardware. I mean, do you think there's going to be a new Surface Studio?
So there's actually one sitting right behind me. I don't think that they would change up the body style in any capacity. While it is a very good machine, if you go look at any of the reviews, when the thing launched, it still has an old-fashioned hard drive. Granted, it is a hybrid drive, but it still has a spinning platter in it. And there's also no Thunderbolt in there either for those high-end devices that creators really demand for external storage. And the graphics chip is actually a little bit dated as well. Even when this thing launched, it's still running the older generation, not what NVIDIA has out at the moment. So what I could see them doing is saying, hey, you know what? We're going to put all solid state in there. We're going to bump the video card and then just call it a day. And they could do very similar things on the Surface Book line as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the Surface Book line because, I mean, obviously that seems ripe for some sort of an announcement at this point. Are there any rumors kind of bubbling up about a Surface Book that you think we're probably going to see at this point?
No, to be honest. So if you would ask me this question maybe in February, it was a little bit dicey. Earlier this year, there were a lot of rumors that Microsoft was going to get rid of that gap in the Surface Book, if you're familiar with that teardrop shape. Mm-hmm. And then there's rumors that, hey, Microsoft's going to get rid of that in their next generation Surface Book. And then the Surface laptop launched and looks like an exact laptop, right? There's no gap. And so I suspect that those rumors were getting crossed and people saying, oh, yeah, they're coming out with a new laptop. And people are thinking that was Surface Book. I honestly, all that I've heard is that they're just going to do a spec bump at this time. It wouldn't surprise me if they potentially try to introduce some color options. Their burgundy Surface laptop has been selling out almost 2-to-1 over some other variants. And then the blue one is also selling well compared to just the standard silver. So it wouldn't surprise me to see them kind of explore those options. And I'm also kind of hearing along some lines that this is going to be more of an ultra premium device. If you go to Microsoft right now with $1,500, you can buy a Surface laptop, you can buy a Surface Pro, or you can buy a Surface Book. There's too many essentially laptops at a certain price point. And it doesn't really make sense, in my opinion, for Microsoft to launch a Surface Book that doesn't have a dedicated GPU, which is currently what's residing in those lower price points. Hmm.
So the burgundy and the blue, those are the ones with the Alcantara on them, right?
Yes. Yep.
Do you think that they're going to continue using that on new devices?
That's a very good question. One of the things that we were kind of surprised is that the Surface Pro doesn't come in any color options either. And maybe that's just their differentiator. I don't think they're going to put the Alcantara on a Surface Book Pro or Surface Book. I kind of hope that they don't. There's a lot of mixed opinions about whether or not people love it or don't like it. And the jury's still out about long-term whether or not this material is actually going to hold up. And so I hope that at the higher price points, they retain just the kind of that bare metal finish.
And then what about, I get a little confused because I hear every once in a while about this Andromeda project, and it reminds me of, you know, I'm so entrenched in the Android world. There was for a while an Andromeda project in Android that seemed to fizzle and die out. But apparently rumors are that Microsoft's working on an Andromeda project as well, piece of hardware. Tell us a little bit about that. And do you think maybe we'll see something like that? Like, are there any hints pointing to that finally seeing the light of day?
Yeah, so what a lot of people refer to as Andromeda as the Surface phone. And so I've heard this is like deep in the skunk work world of Microsoft. I've heard many different things that it's not just a candy bar style like display. Also that Alex Kipman, who worked on the HoloLens and Kinect, is also working on the display technology that is going to be in this device. I'm also hearing that it's going to be more expensive and that it's not intended to be a mass market product. Essentially, what this means, in my opinion, is that they're going to have some sort of Surface mobile device that is probably what they envision as a small computing form factor that maybe uses Continuum for larger display. Will that device show its face here this fall? I'm not hearing that. The last I heard was 2018 at the earliest.
Oh, wow.
And anything is obviously subject to change inside of the world of Microsoft, but I am not expecting to see that device currently this fall, unless they, you know, they pull it out of their hat like they did HoloLens.
Yeah, right.
Do you think that we will see a Surface phone in the fall or ever?
So that's This fall, definitely not. Microsoft just basically got done spending $10 billion, and that's probably even on the short side, on their Windows Mobile strategy. They are in no rush to get back into the mobile hardware space until they think they've got something that will at least sell in some capacity that they can at least try to break even on. They are not going to put out a phone at this point just to have a phone out. They are done. They've washed their hands of that, and they're trying to build something that is truly different than just, say, another candy bar style phone with a different OS that has no apps.
Well, you and Paul Thurrott did a podcast on this that is available for subscribers at Thurrott.com. So if people have more questions about that event, they can go check out that podcast. You also wrote a piece about how Google has been handing out free Chromebooks on the street to everyone. No, not to everyone. to Microsoft Cloud partners. Tell us what you learned about that.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated by the enterprise space right now because we have Amazon, we have Microsoft Azure, and then we also have, I don't want to call them a scrappy competitor, but a challenger, if you will, in the Google Cloud. And all these companies are billion-dollar companies that are dumping quite literally billions of dollars into these data centers. And AWS has by far the biggest lead. Microsoft is catching up pretty quickly and grabbing a nice mind share. And then you have Google, who was late to the game, but they hired somebody named, I believe her name is Diane Greene, and she's done a wonderful job of turning around the Google Cloud business. And it's actually becoming quite the competitor. They've got a long way to go to catch up to AWS and Azure. But I would say over the past couple months or so, I got a lot of tips about how Google has suddenly become very aggressive in their challenging of the enterprise space. And so what one reader finally sent me, I'd been asking for this for a while, is actually what Google is sending out. And they are sending out boxes to people who are reselling Azure, AWS, or who are heavy users of those platforms. And it's a box that has all the literature about Google Cloud and why it's better and why companies like Snapchat and Spotify are using it. And then in there, there's an invitation where you can go to a web link, punch in a certain code, and they will send you a free Chromebook. And then what they do is over, I believe it's Google Hangouts, then they do their Google Cloud pitch. And so you can look at it. Basically, these guys are spending $200 or so or whatever they're paying for a Chromebook as a sales pitch for their cloud services, which, as we all know, those contracts are typically in the millions, if not tens of millions of dollars. So while this may look expensive, for every sale that they get, they reap that reward massively that they can pull away from AWS and Azure.
So it's kind of like when you get invited to stay at a hotel.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
And you just have to listen to this little pitch.
And it's 3 hours.
Yeah. Then you bought a timeshare. Yep. In Google.
Yep.
You bought a timeshare for your stuff in
Google's
cloud.
Yeah. So we'll see if it pays off. Yeah. They've got the cash flow to do this. So it's no sweat off their back.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us. Brad Sams has been breaking Microsoft news for a decade. You can check him out at petri.com. He is a podcaster and the executive editor over there. Thanks so much for coming on, Brad.
Thank you, Brad.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, feedback time. Phil wrote into TNT at twit.tv to say, I just wanted to let you know that you repeatedly referred to the H-1B program incorrectly as the HB-1 program. Just wanted to let you know the proper name of that program. Thank you, Phil. It is the H-1B program. It's easy to get those numbers and letters swapped around from time to time. It happens, but
yes.
We apologize.
No, but yeah, Phil was very nice in his email, and I am always thankful for pointing that out because it means you're listening.
Yeah.
H-1B.
Yes.
TNT's fan of the day is Andy Lewis, who emailed us this picture saying, "The Night King has his eyes on you. Hopefully you have dragon fire."
Oh, you Game of Thrones people.
Okay. Oh, is that Game of Thrones?
Yes. I even had to look it up. Oh, okay. I was like, all right, who is this? And I was afraid of spoilers because I've not seen a single episode of Game of Thrones at this point. I will. Don't worry. At some point I will. But no spoilers. Thank you.
Okay. Good. I don't think. Thank you. Yeah, I read the first book. I watched the first season and then I was done. So I don't know if there were Night Kings in the first book. If they were, I don't remember. Is that what it was? Night Kings? There's only one Night King, Kevin says. One Night King, actually.
Laughter ensued in this studio when the word king was pluralized.
I know winter is coming. That's a Game of Thrones thing. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT with your action figures, with your references to science fiction that I know, like Westworld. Record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT. It does not need to involve action figures, but if it does, it would be cool to see how your action figures.
Yeah, watch all us. Of the Night Kings. Send in all of your Night Kings. We want to see them. Night Mode fans, speaking of night, Night Mode fans, Twitter is throwing you a bone. If you saw how the mobile app integrated Night Mode a while back on iOS and Android, and you appreciated the relief your eyes enjoyed as a result, then you'll be happy to know that Twitter is bringing that Night Mode to the desktop website. However, the desktop implementation doesn't track the time of day to automatically trigger Night Mode when the sun goes down where you happen to be. You'll have to do it manually, but it's pretty easy to do. You just tap your profile, then select Night Mode from the drop-down menu, and your eyes are relieved from all the hours that you spend staring at Twitter in the evening before going to bed, which is a bad idea.
But now you can do it at night.
Yeah, yeah. It's still a bad idea. It's just your eyes will be a little bit less strained as a result. Are you a night mode fan?
No nights mode. Nights.
No nights. Night Kings mode.
No Night Kings mode. No. Now, does your phone automatically know when it's nighttime and move to dark mode? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. Does it not do that on iOS?
I think there is something that does that. It's not, it doesn't turn dark like the night mode, but it like turns like,
Oh, you're talking about, talking about the, where it gives you the little red hue, takes out the blue, the blue light. I can't remember what they call it on iOS. No, this is different. This is inside the app, inside the Twitter app. If you've on Android, anyways, if you go into settings, you can activate night mode and you can tell it to do it dynamically, which essentially it can track when the sun sets. And at that point, the user interface will go from a white theme to a dark theme, and it does it automatically. Then the next morning, you wake up and it's white theme again. So it's like during the day, it's bright. During the night, it's dark.
Okay. On the iPhone, it's called Night Shift. And I can already have it scheduled from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m.
And that's on the OS level. That's removing blue light from on the OS level at that time. Yeah,
it shifts the colors of your display to the warmer end of the color spectrum after dark. Mm-hmm. This may help you get a better night's sleep.
Mm-hmm. It may.
But yeah, I've tried night mode on my Twitter app on iOS, and it's fine.
It's just a dark theme. That's all it really is. Yeah.
But it's supposed to be better for your eyes.
Well, I think they're two different things, right? Like the night shift is actually removing the blue hues, which supposedly is better for your circadian rhythm. In this, like I know on Android for a long time, there's been a lot of people who are really passionate about modding their phones so that they can turn all of their apps into more of dark modes, which on some screens, on like OLED screens, you can only activate pixels that need to be lit up, which actually saves battery instead of lighting up every single pixel on other screen technologies. So having a night mode where everything is truly dark except for, you know, words or whatever, can actually in the long run save battery. So that's one reason why you might do that. It's maybe pleasing for the eye at nighttime when you're in a dark room and you open up an app and it's not this bright white light shining on you. Instead, it's like a dark kind of theme. So it feels better in that way, I suppose.
I try not to read Twitter in the dark in bed at night.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I try.
That's a really good idea. I highly encourage everyone to try not to do that because it's a bad idea. I realize that every single night. Why do I do this to myself? TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. Be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW and find us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
And remember, if you know how much a Facebook ad costs, tweet at me. I'm at Megan Maroney. Or if you want to tell me all the virtues of night mode, you can also find me on Twitter at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Kevin, our technical director and editor. I'm just going to ask you that way every single day. Yes.
Editor?
He sounds kind of annoyed. Or is it Josh today? Okay, it's Kevin.
He sounds really
thrilled about it. I think he's even glaring at me right now. Thank you, Kevin. All right. Thanks to Burke for helping out in the studio. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.